Welcome to the Visible Policing Podcast, where we explore the nature and impact of the visual in relation to contemporary crime and policing. I'm Mike Rowe, Professor of Criminology at Northumbria University. Welcome to this edition of the Visible Policing Podcast. I'm really pleased to introduce our guest speaker today, who is Sarah Mono de Froidville from Victoria University in Wellington in New Zealand. Good evening, Sarah.
Good evening.
Thank you very much for joining.
Well done. Oh, sorry. I was going to just say well done on getting my name right.
Oh, well, I hope I did. Yeah. Thanks very much for joining us. We're really interested in everything to do with visual components, visual dimensions of issues to do with crime and issues to do with policing. And as you know, we wanted to talk to you about some of the work that you've done in this area.
Sure.
Can you just, we're going to talk about a particular case in a few minutes, and I'll ask you for a bit more detail about that, you know, as we get to it. But perhaps you could just, you know, give us a sense of what made you interested in this whole kind of broad area within criminology. It's quite an emerging and relatively new area. What brought you to it, Sarah?
What brought me to it? I have to say it really was that case itself, which we'll talk about in a moment. So it really was that the power of the image that was sitting inside that case and exploring that case, it has kind of exposed me to new understandings about images and their role in criminal justice and understandings about crime. So it's kind of started with that case. I think I kind of had a broad understanding, you know, kind of a background understanding, I guess, as any criminology student would at that point, but it really was tied to that case.
Okay, let's get into that then, because it will it's difficult to have the conversation without going into the details. So this was a case involving a young teenager at the time in New Zealand, Bailey Junior Kuririki. Can you just, you know, give us him for the benefit of listeners who don't necessarily know all the details? Could you just give us a kind of broad overview of the case and the background to it?
Sure. Okay. So Bailey Junior Kuririki, he was actually 12 at the time. He was with a bunch of older kids, five other kids who were all older than him, and they'd got together and decided to call a delivery pizza, and they had made a plan to rob the pizza worker when he or she arrived, and so they proceeded to do that. And as part of that robbery, one of the older young people whacked the pizza worker around the head with a baseball bat. Just to kind of, you know, render him unconscious so that they could steal the money and run away, which they did. And the pizza worker was sadly, fatally injured. He managed to get up and go to the next door neighbour's property, but he went home later that night and he passed away. So, naturally, the police had a murder case on their hands at that point, and they caught up with the six young people, and all of them were charged, I think, with murder. I know that the older ones were, the two older ones were, and Bailey was charged with murder too, even though he had quite a minor role in the event itself. He had just opened the door when the pizza worker arrived, so he didn't have anything to do with the actual physical attack itself, but because he was one of the group, he was seen as implicated in the crime in that way, so he was charged with murder along with the two older ones.
Okay.
And, yeah.
When was this, Sarah?
So, this was back in 2002. So quite a while ago now.
Uh-huh.
And what happened at the time of the murder is that we would see in the media young group have been charged with murder, and we get just basic details about the crime because we didn't really know their names at this point. They'd just been charged, and of course, innocent of proven guilty. The New Zealand public wasn't allowed to know who these young people were. So we had to wait until about a year later, so it was 2003, and after the court case, So that the young people were charged with murder and they went on trial, and Bailey Jr. Kurareki was found not guilty of murder, but he was found guilty of manslaughter. And the following day, after he'd been found, you know, announced guilty of manslaughter, we see in the press, and it was a Sunday, and in New Zealand we have a national Sunday newspaper called the Sunday Star Times, and across the whole of the front page was an image of Bailey, and he was smiling, and he was sitting down, and he was looking away from the camera, and there was a headline kind of situated within the image, and it said, "Our youngest killer." And it was a striking image for so many reasons, partly because Bailey, he didn't look like a killer. He was a really attractive young child. He looked young. Mm. And he was smiling in a kind of, in a way that you wouldn't expect a killer to do, I guess. And then, but we were given the knowledge that actually this was a killer and it was our youngest killer. And so it was disturbing in that way.
And was the picture taken in the courtroom?
What's that? I'm sorry.
Where was the picture from the court case?
Yeah, the picture was taken inside the courtroom. So Bailey had been sitting at a desk with his lawyer and was looking away. So he wasn't looking directly at the camera either. So that was my introduction, and the rest of New Zealand. The New Zealand public's introduction to Bailey himself and not the case itself, but kind of what Bailey looks like and the fact that he was a young person who had been involved in this crime. And from that point on, the fact that there had been five other young people involved in the crime and two older ones in particular, who had actually carried out the fatal attack on the pizza worker, seemed to fall away, and the press focused solely on Bailey Kurareki, and we had an enormous amount of press discourse and information or discourse from like politicians and lobby group spokespeople and leaders of churches and social workers and all of these people coming forward and talking in the press about what was wrong with youth today. So Bailey had somehow within, from the time that image appeared until it was a matter of, say, 2 weeks, I would say, suddenly it was as if Bailey had become symbolic of a national crisis around young criminals. And there was, you know, what are we going to do, was the kind of thing. So it was, in a way, it was, I guess, kind of our version of the Bulger case, for lack of a better comparison. What else can I tell you about the case?
Well, what kind of, I mean, I'm interested in lots of parts of it, and there's lots that we can unpack there. So, I mean, first of all, I suppose, why do you think, Just explain a little bit more, maybe, about why you think that image was so powerful.
So
I mean,
powerful.
I know I understand the point about him looking angelic. I was going to say, I don't know if that's quite the right phrase, but you know, the image of him is at odds with obviously the actions that occurred. So, I mean, can you just talk us through the why was that was would the
sure.
I suppose my question is, would the case of attract would the would the case have attracted so much attention without that image, do you think?
Absolutely, I would say absolutely not. And I can say that because we had a case more recently, say in 2015, where the funny thing was is they didn't put an image of the offender in that case. They actually put an image of Bailey in the more recent case as well. But anyway, going back to Bailey, I think it was powerful partly because of the content, like you say, it was an image of a young child, and he did look angelic. He looked beautiful, and we understand children to be innocent, and innocence has a beauty kind of attached to it. We that's kind of how we understand innocence, and how we understand innocent children are beautiful. But at the same time, it was also there was something about the image because it was taken inside a courtroom, so it had an evidential sense to it, if you like. It wasn't just an image kind of taken anywhere, it was taken inside a courtroom. So there was a truth to it in that respect. And that it had appeared in the Sunday Star Times, it was and on the front page too, that kind of gave it a sense of truth as well, because we understand news images as not being like advertising images, say. We understand them to be factual and giving us the news, giving us the information we need to know now, if you like. So that was, I think, adding to the content of this beautiful child who we had been alerted to as being a killer. So his beauty and his innocence were kind of staring us in the face, but at the same time, there was that innocence was betraying itself because we were being told that he was a killer by the headline. And this was an evidential image and truthful image because it had been taken inside a courtroom and because it was appearing in the Sunday Star Times. So there were all these things going on in this one image. And I think that's the reason why it caused so much talk and so much kerfuffle and so much anxiety and concern in New Zealand society at that time about children going out of control.
And where did the incident occur?
It occurred in Auckland. It occurred in South Auckland. And South Auckland is quite notorious. I don't know what the equivalent in the UK would be necessarily, but South Auckland is quite notorious in the New Zealand context for being a bad area. So you wouldn't want to walk down a street at night in South Auckland, put it that way. It's called the Badlands, colloquially. It just kind of that's its term, yeah.
Okay, so there was that as well.
This is a young, beautiful child, and he's from the Badlands. You know, this is what they look like, and yeah.
And tell me a bit more. You said about the various campaign groups, and I suppose classic kind of moral. We'll come on to moral panic theory a bit more later on. But I mean, these would be the kind of moral entrepreneurs, wouldn't they?
Absolutely.
Get talked about. So tell me about them.
Sure. In particular, that we have a group here called the Sensible Sentencing Trust, and anyone who's done any work kind of looking at, say, prisons and incarceration in the New Zealand context will have an understanding that we have a phenomenon called penal populism. So we've got quite a high incarceration rate compared to our crime rates. We like to lock people up, basically.
Okay.
And that's been happening for, with some zest, for about two decades now. And it really was just getting off ground in 2002. And part of the reason it got off ground was the beginnings of this lobby group called the Sensible Sentencing Trust that had emerged in relation to a crime that had an older woman who had been victimised and beaten up and what have you. And so there was some outrage about that. And so Garth McVicar took it upon himself. He's the spokesperson. He's the leader of the Sensible Sentencing Trust. To develop the Sensible Sentencing Trust, and so he became the spokesperson for ordinary New Zealanders, and he often appeared in the media talking about how crime was out of control and politicians were wrong, and politicians actually started at that point to play a bit of a game with each other. It was who could be the toughest on crime, who could demonstrate how tough they were going to be, and that became a bit of a political football, and who the toughest would get the most votes. So, and that was just starting at that point. So by the time, 2002, this case was almost like fodder, if you like, in their hands, and Garth McVicar had quite a lot to say about Bailey and about the crime against the pizza worker too, and he said he was an evil little so-and-so, and this was just evidence that New Zealand's world-leading youth justice system was actually out of control, And this was also evidence that that the government wasn't doing anything about crime and justice and law and order in New Zealand. And so it really kind of helped propel that sense amongst the New Zealand public that they weren't safe anymore. And the awful thing was is that now it appeared that they weren't safe from children. And, you know, if you're not safe from children, then what else is there?
Sure. So there's, there's this, sort of way in which this becomes a kind of symbolic case, isn't there? I suppose you've got the content of the image, but also that it's playing out in a particular sort of political background that gives fuel to the fire, I suppose, in terms of raising the profile of it. Was there anything about the kind of ethnicity and the way in which that played out? Could you just talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So Bailey was, he's actually Rarotongan, which is a small island just north of New Zealand, and very closely related to the New Zealand Māori, the indigenous people of New Zealand. And you could see that he was brown-skinned in the image of him. And so in New Zealand, where Māori are typically overrepresented in criminal justice statistics. So Māori make up about 14% of the population, but they make up over 50% of the prison population. So there's quite a practice, I guess, of over-criminalisation of Māori people, and Māori people are it's not that they commit more crime, but that they feature in the negative social statistics more often, the ones that we associate with more criminality as well. And there's also, issues of institutional bias and all that kind of thing. But what that's created in turn is a kind of a narrative and a thread, an understanding that criminality goes alongside being Māori. And so this image played right into that as well. It was kind of, it confirmed many things. So it confirmed that narrative. It sat really nicely within that narrative. And it also sat really nicely within the narrative of, New Zealanders are no longer safe. But it also was very disturbing because it was a child. And we're supposed to be safe from children, and children aren't supposed to commit these horrible crimes. So it had all of this kind of wrapped up in this one image. Yeah, and I think that's why it was so outstandingly powerful.
Yes, absolutely. And you've already mentioned the Bulger case in the UK, and of course there have been other notable cases in other parts of the world, during the relatively recent past. And it's interesting to see how these themes kind of play out in similar ways in different jurisdictions in different periods, but there's also, there are differences as well as similarities. And you've kind of given something of the context of this New Zealand example really, really nicely there. What do you think? I mean, let's if you're okay to move on to talk a bit more about some of the wider implications, because I know you're interested in thinking about the implications of this case in terms of wider debates about moral panics, one of the few criminological concepts that's really entered the public imagination. But of course, many people would argue it's been distorted and misinterpreted as it's emerged in public debate. But we'll come on to all of that maybe. But what do you think the implications are in terms of moral panic theory?
The image itself or this case itself?
Well, both really, I suppose. Talk about both of those perhaps.
I think what it shows is that moral panics, I was interested in it because it was incredibly sudden after that image appeared, that suddenly we had an explosion of discourse from all sorts of corners in New Zealand, all appearing in the media. So the media kind of had an active part in that as well, because it was regurgitating what people were saying, and the media is well known to be quite active within a moral panic construction. So for me, it wasn't just a kind of an issue, say, of youth being out of control or youth being more criminogenic or the New Zealand public not being safe or anything like that. So it wasn't any kind of issue that had triggered it, like, say, the Mods and Rockers, the classic moral panic, the first moral panic that was understood by Stanley Cohen. So in that case, in the Mods and Rockers, it was the clashes in Clacton between the Mods and the Rockers that got the panic started. But in this case, it was the image, the appearance of the image. It wasn't even the crime so much. It was the appearance of the image. So this said to me that that images alone can spark a moral panic, and that was what my PhD research focused on. So I think the implications there are huge, really, because it's kind of like it's even though the image was presented to us as a truthful image and as an evidential image, it was nevertheless constructed in a particular way. I'm sure that the photographer who took that image took a whole bunch around it, but that we didn't see, and that he chose that image to appear because he knew it was powerful. And so that kind of has implications in terms of what narratives are we being presented that are then going to spark moral panics. And moral panics are known to be episodes of heightened concern about an issue that the concern doesn't match the objective reality. So if something like that, and if an episode can be sparked off with an image that is being constructed or chosen to spark off a particular set of ideas, then, I mean, that's kind of scary. It really kind of speaks to, I want to say fake news, but that's not quite the right term. So it kind of speaks to the way that our you know, hyper-construction of social life now, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, and this, of course, was during a period sort of, well, maybe in the very early days of social media, but you know, social media has become much more significant since 2003. I would think most people would probably agree. So I mean, I wonder, you know, does the I don't know whether you can comment on this, but does the image have a kind of continuing sort of afterlife, if you like, on social media? Does it still crop up? I mean, images being much more important on social media even than in old media.
Images. Do you mean that specific image or image?
Well, I mean, I was thinking of that particular image, but I mean, it might be what you're talking about seems to be even more relevant, at least potentially even more relevant in a social media era than it was in the early noughties.
Twitter too. Twitter. Understanding that journalists also use Twitter as a resource, so they could. Anybody taking an image anywhere could be construed and kind of given a narrative and what have you. But that image of Bailey in particular, it had an enormous salience, and it would appear years later, even as Bailey himself, the actual person, aged, that image of him at 13 years old in court would appear repeatedly in the news, often when another child would or a young person would commit a crime. So that image would appear, and it was almost like a warning. Mm. Oh, here's another one. this is another piece of the evidence of children out of control. And I remember writing a letter to the editor once. It was about 2006, and or maybe a little bit after that, but one of our members of parliament had put forth a member's bill for a young offenders bill, and he wanted to strengthen some of our laws around young offenders, and he wanted to bring the age of criminal responsibility down and all that kind of thing, and because it was 12 at the time, I think. No, it wasn't, it was 10. but he wanted to make it harsher.
Wow.
I can't quite remember exactly what the details were, but nevertheless. So, and I remember writing a letter to the editor arguing against this, and lo and behold, next to my letter was an image of Bailey.
Oh.
Because I'd talked about this, and that was exactly what I didn't want to happen, because I was trying to argue against the discourse and the panic that had erupted around that particular image, and there I'd gone and kind of stimulated its reproduction.
Unintended consequences, say. I suppose.
And even up until, I'd mentioned before, 2015, and we had a case here in New Zealand where a 13-year-old had been involved in a crime quite similar to the one back in 2002 that Bailey had been involved in. But in this case, after the child had been found guilty of manslaughter, like Bailey had, the judge decided that he was going to give this child permanent name suppression, which meant that the press couldn't take pictures of him sitting in the courtroom and give them to put them on the front page of the paper. So what the press did instead was put an image of Bailey in their story about this new crime and this other child. So that was quite stunning, I thought. So, even though the paper had, or the article had nothing to do with, really, with Bailey, it was now 13 years later, but that image is still appearing.
That's the kind of touchstone image then that people will go back to, I suppose, then, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. It's what they understand. The Bailey's now kind of understood as New Zealand's youngest killer, which is what the headline was inside that image. And it's often, when I talk about the case with people, and I was just talking about it last week at an event that I was at around reducing the age of criminal responsibility again. And that case came up, and people were interested to know exactly the details about it. And people are shocked when they learn that actually all Bailey did was open the door, because they've become so used to seeing his image attached to that label, New Zealand's Youngest Killer, and seeing it repeated over and over and over in the New Zealand press. So to them, their understanding is that Bailey delivered the fatal attack onto the pizza worker, and that's not the case. Yes, he was involved, and yes, it was a horrible crime, and yes, it was, somebody died, and it's not great on any level, but he was not responsible for the fatal attack, which is what everybody believes.
Yes, and without the image that you mentioned before, which people can find on the internet easily enough, without
sure.
the it's unfortunate that we're talking about this in a way we can't illustrate it, but nonetheless, without that image, you feel that this long and continuing story of misrepresentation of what happened, I suppose, in many ways, wouldn't have unwrapped in the way that it did.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I don't see how it could have. That case that happened in 2015 is kind of really speaks volumes about the power of that image. Because being quite parallel cases and not being able to produce an image of this second child in 2015, and as a result of that, there's been no hoo-ha, no discourse, no panic erupt around the 2015 case at all.
That illustrates it very neatly. Well, thank you very much, Sarah. Is there anywhere people can read more about this in terms of your work? Can you suggest some further readings for people who are interested?
Sure. Specifically to do with the image, I do have an article in Critical Criminology. It's called Portraying Those We Condemn with Care, Extending the Ethics of Representation. And it's under the name Sarah Wright Mono. So I'm kind of combining my maiden name and my married name.
And when
very,
was that,
very confusing.
When was that published, Sarah?
So that was published 2017, And my argument in there is just that we need to be careful with the images that we use of our offenders, because they can do these things that we've just talked about.
Can I
add something to that?
Please do.
So my argument in that paper was also about the implications, not for Bailey himself too. So if you imagine, this is a child that has been caught up with a bunch of older children, which is, you know, young people tend to offend within the context of their peers, and tend to kind of go along with what their peers say. That's quite well known in, for those people who study youth justice. But for Bailey himself, that image has had an enormous impact too, because he is, because people understand him as New Zealand's youngest killer, he's not able to kind of shake that off him in any way possible. And I do believe actually that he is still inside. I know that he was sentenced to 7 years prison. He was let out after 6 years, 8 months, and then he had 2 months in a parole period, and he was hounded in that 2 months by the New Zealand press, all anxious to get an updated image to put alongside that image, that first image that appeared in the courtroom in the Sunday Star Times. And yeah, it was horrendous. And so Bailey didn't feel safe for a very, very long time, and he was very... he was actually hounded by the police as well. And I do understand from contacts that I have in the criminal justice system that he often just asked to go back to prison because he was safer there, because the paparazzi couldn't get hold of him. So, you know, that's had an enormous impact on him in that way too. So that's kind of the ethics of my argument.
I was just going to say
actually we need to be careful. Yeah,
I mean, that's a really powerful example of criminalisation, isn't it? And how the, you know, the impact is obviously in, as you've described it, the impact's very significant on a social and political level, but also on a human level, obviously, too. And you've illustrated that very nicely.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much indeed, Sarah. Fascinating to talk to you. It's a really interesting case, and I'm delighted that you've spared some time to talk to us about all of that. So thank you very much, and I'd point people in the direction of the article you mentioned.
Great. It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
This podcast is produced as part of an Economic and Social Research Council funded study, Visible Policing. For more information, visit visiblepolicing.com.